Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with George Galloway, who is the Respect Party Member of Parliament for Bethnal Green and Bow in the United Kingdom. He won his seat after his expulsion from the Labour Party. He has been a long-time critic of the war in Iraq. And he has now written a book called Mr. Galloway Goes to Washington, which tells the story of his account of his confrontation at the United States Senate subcommittee chaired by Senator Norm Coleman. Coleman had accused Mr. Galloway of fraud in his charity designed to help the children of Iraq from the UN sanctions. Galloway turned the tables on the senators in a blistering attack which left the senators reeling and speechless, accustomed as they are to the tepid and controlled discourse which passes for political debate in Washington, D.C. George Galloway will be joining us on tape. We had to pre-record him because he is now, as we speak, going back to England. He spoke yesterday at the anti-war rally in Washington, D.C. We'll also speak with Dr. Robert Pastor, who is the director of the Center for Democracy and Election Management, and he's the vice president of the International Affairs at American University. He was the director of the Carter Baker Commission on Federal Election Reform. They just released their report this week on how to fix the broken American electoral system. He has been with the Carter Center, where he's developed techniques of election mediation and organized the observation of more than 30 elections throughout the world. And he's also been a senior advisor to the Carter Ford National Commission on Election Reform, and of course was served on the National Security Council under President Jimmy Carter. We'll also talk about the United States pulling out of the comprehensive test ban, which goes all the way back to President Kennedy. The United States has joined essentially the rogue nations of the world. We'll be talking with Michael Harris, who's the author of a new book, The Atomic Times, My H-Bomb Years at the Pacific Proving Ground. And Michael Harris, as a young man, witnessed 12 H-bombs going off. He began writing The Atomic Times, his book, in 1955. He just finished it. He spent most of his adult life as an executive at CBS Television, 11 years with The Ed Sullivan Show, and, of course, as a bonus, he welcomed the Beatles at the airport on their first trip to the United States. But we're talking about nuclear weapons, not the Beatles. So let's now go to speak with George Galloway, who, as I mentioned, I had to record earlier by telephone. He is now crossing the Atlantic, having spoken yesterday at the anti-war rally in Washington, D.C.
I speak to George Galloway, who's a British MP for the Respect Member of Parliament for Bethnal Green and Bow. He was previously elected to the Labour Party representing Glasgow. And he campaigned against sanctions in Iraq, made several trips to that country, met Saddam Hussein in 1994 and 2002, was expelled from the Labour Party in October of 2003 for his statements against the 2003 invasion of Iraq, and is now a member of the Respect Unity Coalition, having been elected in the 2005 general election. And you're touring this country, George Galloway, with your book, Mr. Galloway Goes to Washington. I believe, in fact, you do go to Washington.
Yes, the red eye this evening from Los Angeles, and I hope to be marching with many thousands of others in D.C. tomorrow.
Well, there's an expectation of 100,000 people.
That would be fantastic.
And, of course, the president will be out of town. But
is he on holiday still in Crawford?
No, he's probably going to Colorado.
Oh,
although there is a hurricane bearing down on Texas. So tell me about what you, without stealing your thunder, what you're planning to say in Washington.
Well, that our two countries are the biggest problem in the world today. We are the biggest threat to peace and stability in the world today. And those of us in those two countries who say, not in my name, should be standing together as closely, shoulder to shoulder, as our two leaders have been doing over this last disastrous period in world affairs. And the purpose of my coming, not just to promote the book, Mr. Galloway Goes to Washington, though I must say every night there's more than 1,000 people come. Most of them buy the book, and I've got a very sore right wrist from signing them. But to be a bridge, if you like, to help construct a bridge across which many people from the anti-war movement and the progressive political trends should pass. Oscar Wilde said we were two people divided by a common language. I'm not quite sure why we've ended up as not divided but separate from each other as we have, given how closely our two countries are working together in world affairs at a governmental level. So I'm hoping that we can be a people's bridge between the two countries, and all the signs are that there are many willing partners here in the U.S. for that.
Indeed, it's puzzling why the British people and most of the Europeans and rest of the world seem to be, the majority seem to be against this war, yet the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, seems to be, he suffered greatly for it. President Bush is only now beginning to, I think, feel the pressure. Why do you think we're on a slow learning curve over here?
Well, I think we were all on a slow learning curve. You know, imperialist countries, once the drums start beating and the tinny bugle of fake patriotism starts blowing, can comparatively easily in the short term be dragooned into disastrous wars. But there's a law of diminishing returns, I think. And quite quickly, much more quickly than the Bush and Blair gang counted on, I think, people saw through the Iraq adventure for what it was, based on a pack of lies and with catastrophic results. And Aznar paid the price first. The Spanish premier was swept from power. Mr. Blair then lost half of his parliamentary majority. He lost half, more than half, actually, of the Labour Party's members, which has more than halved since he took it over. And his historical reputation is, of course, completely discredited. He will be remembered for nothing other than having strapped himself into the back seat of a car driven by a drunk called George W. Bush over a cliff, and we've not even hit the bottom yet. So Mr. Blair will have many years, I think, to regret the bizarre special relationship he formed with George Bush. And I think that here in the United States, the political landscape has changed pretty dramatically over the last couple of months, two, 3 months, and by a confluence which could never have been foreseen. The bravery of Cindy Sheehan and other mothers of young soldiers laid in the ground as a result of this war, and the disaster of Katrina and its aftermath, and all the malevolence and incompetence that was shown by the administration in the wake of that disaster, proving that they were not just, as I say, malevolent, but bumbling fools who couldn't even organize the picking up of dead bodies in one of their own great cities 7 days after they had first lain there. This gave the lie to the idea that the United States has got either the ability to, or frankly should have the appetite to, be sailing around the world invading other people's countries and trying to get them right when their own country is so far from right. And the racism, venality that we saw and heard Mrs. Bush, a later day Marie Antoinette, more or less asking why didn't the poor in the Astrodome eat cake, has all exposed the American political classes standing naked in front of the world, and not a pretty sight.
And do you therefore think, George Galloway, that a better argument is, rather than moral outrage, couldn't one make a stronger case, particularly to convince those people who supported this war in this country, that these people are incompetent? I mean, they have turned a semi-stable area of the world into a completely unstable area of the world, and even the Saudi leaders just yesterday complained of that very fact, that that there's a possibility of a civil war now in Iraq that could explode into a little turmoil in the Middle East.
Yes, our leaders are either fools or knaves. I'm not sure which is worse, whether it's better to be ruled by a fool Or a knave. I suppose there's a fair argument for saying that the United States is ruled by someone who's both. But either way, it's a catastrophe. When the French statesman Talleyrand was told of the murder of a political opponent by one of his aides who said it's a terrible crime, Talleyrand answered, it's worse than a crime, it's a blunder. And there's no doubt that the attack upon Iraq has been, for me, a crime, but certainly for the vast majority of people in the world, a blunder. And you're right, the danger of a civil war, a Yugoslav-type war on top of the world's biggest oil field, on a confessional basis, dragging in the surrounding populations, even governments, of Iran and the Arab countries, and people won't have to worry about oil at $70 a barrel. You won't be able to buy a barrel of oil at any price, and there'll be economic catastrophe all around the world.
And there are, of course, there is a school of thought that suggests that the neocons planned this all along. That seems to me to be a bit of a stretch. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I certainly don't believe they planned it all along, but I think that they hoped to profit from it, and they knew that the consequences of some of their actions would lead to instability. It's like the creation of Frankenstein's monster. You just don't know how ferocious a monster it's going to turn out to be. And there was a lot of neocon thinking that wanted to turn the Middle East into a crucible, was the word they used, and in the white hot heat of that crucible, they hoped to fashion something in their own image. But of course, this was a fantasy, and the outcome has been a crucible, all right. And in that crucible is being forged 10,000 new bin Ladens, more and more hatred and aggression against the West, the collapse of the center in politics in the Muslim world, the collapse of socialism, the collapse of nationalism, and the burgeoning growth of Islamism. Not all Islamism is bin Ladenism, of course, but that trend, the Islamist trend, has been fantastically inflated by the policies of Bush and Blair, and it's a very dubious achievement in policy. If you look at Iraq, Iraq is now in the hands of grand ayatollahs, whose main allegiance, frankly, is to the Islamic Republic of Iran. That seems to me a very dubious achievement for Western policy.
But if a class of civilization, it's as though some think it's inevitable, but it's clearly avoidable. But we seem to be inexorably heading in that direction with this kind of symbiosis between the neocons and the bin Ladens.
There are two sides of the same coin, and both of them believe in Armageddon, and both of them are trying very hard to get us there as quickly as possible. And that's why the rest of us have got to say, stop the world, I want to get off. I'm not prepared to go down that road. And I think that's beginning to happen.
Well, in spite of the fact that 60 million copies of it's the second biggest seller in this country after Harry Potter, the End of the World books. But clearly, a president who believes in the end of the world should be impeached. You have
impeached or taken away by men in white coats.
We, of course, here in the United States, we saw you on television being appearing before the Senate committee that was looking into the Oil for Food program, and the consensus and the reviews on that are pretty much that it backfired on Senator Norm Coleman.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, Kofi Annan was asked about Norm Coleman's war against the United Nations, and he basically said Norm Coleman is not the United Nations' problems, he's the Senate's problem.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why it is that you, why do you think there is this obsession over here amongst conservative and Republican politicians about the United Nations?
Well, they hate Kofi Annan because he said that their war was illegal, which was a very decisive factor in its being held to be that by the vast majority of people in the world. They hoped to bully and bribe and browbeat the United Nations into endorsing their war, and it did not, and it will take a long time for them to forgive that. And of course, on the far shores of the American right, there has always been this, frankly, bizarre belief that the United Nations was a kind of world government Jewish Masonic communist plot to take over the United States and introduce socialism. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. As it happens, in Iraq, the United Nations is hated even more than the United States. It was the United Nations that presided over an economic sanctions regime that killed 1 million Iraqis, most of them children. But the hatred of the Boltons and so on of the world, of the institution in which they're the most important member, is as plain as can be.
But you know, there is an inherent contradiction here, George Galloway. On the one hand, the far right believes that in black helicopters and the UN wants to impose world government.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, they argue that the United Nations is ineffectual.
Yes. Yes, that's
somebody
right.
Ought to make up their mind here.
That's right. An organization that John Bolton said would be better without the upper floors. I don't know how he intended to bring them down or whether the people were supposed to stay inside them when they were being brought down, but he said that the UN would be better without the top five or seven, I can't remember how many stories.
10 floors, yes.
Yes, there is a contradiction in that, but above all, they're highlighting this issue as a smokescreen. They want the world to be fixated on whether or not Kofi Annan's son got a Mercedes car because his dad was the Secretary General of the UN. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. If he did, he shouldn't have. But frankly, that doesn't add up to a row of beans compared to the grand larceny of tens and tens of billions of dollars stolen by the United States and its puppets from the American taxpayer as well as from the Iraqis.
Well, you know, the Iraqi minister just recently spoke in England to the Independent, saying
yes.
That $2 billion went missing under the Alawi regime.
It's the biggest single theft in world history. It was under the watch of Mr. Paul Bremer and the United States.
Well, tell me just in closing then, George Galloway, you mentioned earlier this inexorable clash of civilization, the rise of bin Ladenism as a result of our blundering footprint there in the Middle East. Clearly it would seem that the only way out of this mess is no Christians or Jews can dissuade Islamists from becoming radicals. The only people who can do that are moderate Islamists. All of our policies seem to undercut and marginalize those people. Is there a way that a political movement can be brought to the public's attention in terms of reversing this suicide pact we seem to have with history?
Well, there was no need for you to bring me on here because you're a better spokesman for this point of view than I am. The only thing I would add to what you've just said, which was brilliantly put, is that I'm not asking us to negotiate with bin Laden. I'm asking us to negotiate with the Muslims who haven't joined him yet, but who may join him tomorrow or the next day as a result of their boiling anger and wrath at the policies of injustice being followed by the governments of the West. And if we don't do that, then we are assembling for ourselves an army of people who hate us and who have logical reasons to hate us. Every bullet in the back of a Palestinian child in the Gaza Strip is paid for by the American taxpayer. Every settler who was eventually prized after nearly 40 years out of the illegally held land in the Gaza Strip was given $250,000 in compensation by the American taxpayer. Every helicopter, gunship, every aeroplane that swoops out of the sky in Palestine is paid for by the American taxpayer. If we go on like this, if we go on propping up the puppet presidents and the corrupt kings of the Muslim world, if we go on slaughtering Iraqis and torturing them in Abu Ghraib or elsewhere, then we are really storing up a generation after generation of hatred and trouble that will scar the face of the world and make life intolerable, unbearable for our children and their children yet unborn.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, George Galloway.
You're welcome.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then earlier with George Galloway, who's a member of the Respect Party of the United Kingdom's Parliament, and he was expelled from the Labour Party for his criticism of the US invasion of Iraq. He spoke yesterday at the anti-war demonstration in Washington, D.C., and of course is a controversial figure who has recently been attacked by Christopher Hitchens and Greg Palast from the left. So people are welcome to look at both their attacks and his response to get a fuller picture if they wish. I'm now speaking with Dr. Robert Pastor, who is the director of the Center for Democracy and Election Management and Vice President of International Affairs at American University. He has was also the Executive Director of the Carter-Baker Commission on Federal Election Reform, which just this week published its recommendations intended to increase voter participation, enhance ballot security, reduce fraud, and make election administrations impartial, nonpartisan, and provide a paper auditing for electronic voting machines. And previously, Robert Pastor has been with the Carter Center. He developed a technique of election mediation and organized the observation of more than 30 elections throughout the world. He also served on the Jimmy Carter's National Security Council and was a senior advisor to the Carter Ford National Commission on Election Reform. And this report that you issued this week that was headlined by President Jimmy Carter and James Baker, the voting reform is well. Let's go back to HAVA, the Help Americans Vote Act, that came after the 2000 elections. I think for the first time, the American people and certainly the people throughout the world saw their electoral system as something akin to a banana republics, and there was a lot of money was poured into this. So, what happened to HAVA?
Well, you're quite right. The election of 2000 was the first one really to rivet the attention in the 20th century, or for more than 130 years, of the American people on the nature of our electoral system and what they saw they didn't like. Carter and Ford put together a commission, recommended a series of improvements. Congress worked very slowly, but ultimately it did pass the Help America Vote Act, which was an historic achievement because it was really the first time the U.S. Congress had ever passed a comprehensive bill on election administration. But it didn't go very far, and that was the reason that Jimmy Carter and James Baker decided to come back together after the election of 2004, seeing many of the problems that we'd seen repeat from 2000, and urged additional steps to correct the remainder of those problems.
And, of course, ironically, James Baker handled, he sort of out-lawyered, if you will, Al Gore's lawyers down there in 2000 in Florida.
Well, whether he out-lawyered them or not, I mean, nobody accused him of stepping outside of the law in making the case for George W. Bush. He did play a very active role, but he also is a leading Republican with a great deal of credibility. And what Carter and I both felt was that we were fortunate that the Republicans put his name forward as the co-chair, because Carter and Baker together could begin to transcend the huge divide that is open between the two political parties and have prevented any electoral reform at all.
And indeed, on the NewsHour, James Baker mentioned the pervasive cynicism in this country and the doubts that exist about the integrity of the electoral system. I mean, I get calls here on this radio show from people who essentially are reinforcing despair by saying, what's the point of voting because the electronic machines are rigged?
Yeah, we feel that that's the single greatest danger right now to our democratic system, the feeling of despair, the feeling of a loss of confidence in the electoral process. And it's towards that goal, that is of restoring confidence in the electoral process, that Carter and Baker spent in a very intensive 6 months chairing two public sessions and numerous private sessions and conversations to try to hammer out not the lowest common denominator between the two parties, but really a model for where we should go from here.
Well, let me ask to start then, Robert Pastor, with the most difficult part, at least it appears to be the most difficult part of the recommendations, and that is to take the electoral system, which of course is run by the states, out of the hands of partisans, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, and into some kind of nonpartisan hand. I mean, I think it's fair to, perhaps cynical, to look at the history of voting and to recognize that both sides have been able to game the system because it's been so easy to game. And I mean, and in the last election in Ohio, for example, the Democratic, heavily Democratic African American precincts, people had to wait forever because there weren't any machines, but people in the Republican rural areas voted in minutes as opposed to waiting for hours. And you can see the 14th Amendment kinds of implications of that. So am I correct in suggesting that it has sort of invited corruption for a long time?
Yes, I think that's quite correct. But let me just say, I think there are two other very important recommendations that relate to election administration. The first is states have not actually been in control. They have devolved authority to localities. There are 13,000 separate sovereign units that have governed our elections, and I would say that's the principal reason we've had such problems. Not just that there were so many, but that we have devolved authority to the lowest and poorest level of our government, and therefore the difference between rich and poor neighborhoods, which often coincides with differences in race and obviously in class, are huge. So the first thing is to recommend that authority go to the states. The second is to recommend a strong role for the Federal Election Administration Commission. And the third is the one you pointed to change the model of election administration from that of either being governed by partisans, such as the secretaries of state in each state, who are ultimately in charge and happen to be, in most cases, aspiring politicians, and to move from partisan to bipartisan to nonpartisan. Bipartisan is the model that's been used for both the Federal Election Commission and the Election Assistance Commission, and that is usually a conspiracy against the public. And that's why we recommend that the U.S. follows most of the new democracies all over the world in going towards an independent election commission which is nonpartisan.
And, of course, other aspect of it is the idea of a voter ID card, because the thing that's paralyzed this debate, it seems, is that one man's franchise is another man's fraud. And in the post-9/11 climate, it seems that inevitable, and particularly those that are concerned about border security, particularly on the southern border with Mexico, are pushing for a national ID card. So if a national ID card is inevitable, then wouldn't that automatically take care of this notion of fraud?
Well, it would take care of one element of the fraud, without question. Yeah, I think the United States is moving in a willy-nilly fashion towards a kind of national ID for reasons of security, perhaps immigration, perhaps voting. And I think the best world of all would be if they were all combined, that you didn't see a multiplicity of IDs. But just in the area of voting, there's been a tremendous movement towards requiring IDs. We've gone from 10 to 24 states now that require IDs, another 12 states reconsidering it. And so therefore, the commission evaluated that and said that a possible source of discrimination is the multiplicity of requirements, and therefore we would all be better off if there was a single uniform standard. And as that standard, the commission recommended we use the Real ID Card Act, which passed and was signed in May 2005, in which our driver's licenses in each state will have to fulfill a number of federal requirements, and as they fulfill those requirements, that card could also be used for voting ID as well. And for those people who don't have driver's licenses, the commission recommended an affirmative role on the part of the state to reach out through mobile offices and many offices and provide free IDs for other citizens too. So we think that will transcend this sterile debate between integrity and access, both of which are essential dimensions of a free and democratic process, and indeed not only give added integrity, but increase the number of voters who are registered to and have photo IDs.
But already we have echoes of Jim Crow in Georgia. The legislature just passed a bill requiring voters to spend, I think, $25 to get on the rolls and $40 for 5 years and $40 for 10. I'm not quite sure. But in any case, President Carter considers that retrogression, an abomination. Yes.
Yeah. So, we had our
like
last
a, it's a,
meeting
essentially
in
a poll tax, right?
Yeah, that's right. We had our last meeting in Georgia, and Carter was vehemently opposed to that, and determined that our proposal would not only address the underlying problems with Georgia, but go beyond any other system to come up with one that would be fair and that would not disenfranchise, but rather would lead to the enfranchisement of a larger group of marginalized citizens. And the Republicans on the commission, which were initially reluctant, nonetheless accepted something quite significant and precedent-shattering for the United States, and that is that the states ought to have an affirmative role to register our citizens. This is true of most countries, most democracies in the world, but it's not true of the U.S. The role of registering in the United States is a passive role. People have to go in and register. Here we're recommending that the state has a responsibility to reach out to those who are marginalized, those who are disenfranchised, those who are poor, and make sure that they are registered, and that's part of our proposal.
Well, there,
and furthermore, that it should be, the photo ID should be for free. It can't, we can't charge for photo ID for voting, because that would be, in effect, a poll tax. So we're against that.
But there was resistance to the Motor Voter Act, which was also designed to make voting easy. So how do you, for example, after the last elections, where the Republicans delivered almost every white suburban churchgoer, and I recall Senator Kennedy saying, you know, there are 40 million unregistered minorities in the South. And I think after the Katrina hurricane, I think a lot of people on television saw this American underclass. How would you get people that are poor, now they're homeless, how would you get these cards to them? Given that some addresses are you know, hard to pin down, I mean, isn't there an inherent disadvantage here that the people, the affluent who have driver's license, have an advantage?
Absolutely, and that's precisely why we were able to transcend that with a different role to be played by the state. There is a disadvantage under the current system because it's a passive system, but Carter and I have observed elections all over the world, and every country has been a lot poorer than the United States, and almost every country has been able to register its most impoverished citizens by playing a more active role. I don't see any reason why the United States can't do what Jamaica and Guyana and Liberia and the West Bank can do, which is go out and register 99% of their citizens. I think we can do that. We haven't tried it up until now. Our commission recommends a mobile, aggressive, and affirmative approach to go out and register just those very people. And that was a consensus recommendation of all the Democrats and all the Republicans. So I think in many ways our proposal on IDs is the most significant, particularly from the direction of those who are disenfranchised, because it underscores the importance of playing an affirmative role to register its citizens.
But isn't it incumbent upon the Democratic Party to register these people? I mean, that's the way it works in this country, isn't it? You'd either register a Democrat, Independent, or a Republican.
Well, we think this is a civic responsibility that everybody should help in doing it, but it shouldn't be a responsibility in which the state governments have no role. Which has been the case up until our recommendation. The states themselves ought to have... The problem in Georgia was not just that they charged for a photo ID, but that they opened up like 55 offices out of 159 counties in the state of Georgia. And indeed, there was not one office opened up in Atlanta. So the problem is that the state not only didn't make it accessible enough on a passive basis, but had no intention of reaching out to the poor and to the others. That's what our recommendation aims to do.
And is that the work of the former head of the Christian Coalition who campaigned against Max Cleland?
In Georgia, you mean?
In Georgia, yes. Yeah.
To be honest with you, I didn't follow the politics of it, but the state legislature and the governor are Republicans.
No, I was thinking of Ralph Reed. He's the director of the Republican Party. And,
Yeah, I'm sure that he was supportive of it.
Right.
I don't know what role he played.
Well, I know you you're being bipartisan, which is the whole, or nonpartisan, which is the whole point of this exercise. But just in closing, Robert Pastor, let's address the paranoia about the electronic voting machines.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that a paper trail doesn't necessarily mean anything because the system can be fixed at the computer node level. So what is the point of getting a piece of paper if the paper's not counted and not available for a recount?
Well, we recommend that the paper, that first of all, one has to recognize there has been a movement towards electronic machines, which is quite profound in the country, and that these electronic machines can do things, including multiple languages that you can't do from paper. And therefore there is a dimension to them that's very much advantageous. But at the same time, we've all had experience with computer malfunctions. And when the electronic machine malfunctions, you can lose votes or you may not be sure that the votes are the same ones that you counted. So those concerns plus the source codes are legitimate concerns, and we take aim at that in our recommendations. And we recommend a voter verifiable paper audit trail, essentially for four reasons. First, to increase citizens' confidence that their vote will be counted accurately. They can view the paper and their vote to make sure that's counted, that there is a record of how they voted. Secondly, to allow for recount. You can't have a recount if the computer malfunctions. Thirdly, to provide a backup in cases in which there's a loss of voters due to computer malfunction. And fourthly, to test through a random selection of machines whether the paper result is the same as the electronic result. In short, we recommend an audit. And over time, we believe that this will further encourage the manufacturers to make sure that their computers are error-free, but in cases when they break down, you at least have a paper that can verify the true result of that. So I think these concerns are quite justified, and I think the recommendation goes to ways to reassure voters that there will not be manipulation.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Pastor, a political science question. I was born in Australia, and you may know that in Australia there's you get fined if you don't vote. Mm-hmm. You get like a parking ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And they have tremendous turnout as a result. Mm-hmm. And even though it doesn't violate any kind of freedom of speech ethics, because you can just do what they call a donkey vote. So it's not as if it's people that are dragooned into voting. Why do you think in this democracy we have the lowest voting in the world? I worked in this last election for Rock the Vote to get young people registered, and frankly we did get a couple of million extra people registered, but they didn't necessarily vote. So I'm totally mystified.
Well, Australia has given us the secret ballot in the 1880s, and it has instant runoff and proportional representation and compulsory voting. All of these, I personally believe, are significant initiatives that ought to be considered by the United States as a way to enhance voting. We looked at a number of different methods to try to increase both registration and voting. The evidence is not clear, for example, with early voting or absentee or mail-in votes or voting centers, but it is reasonably clear that those countries like Australia and Belgium that do have compulsory voting, they do have a much larger percentage of people who turn out. And even if, in the case of Belgium, they are not fined, as they are supposed to be in Australia, because people over time begin to realize this is their civic responsibility. The United States, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on which side of this position you fall, is not ready for those kinds of initiatives. That was clear from our debate, but I can tell you that we did put before the Commission all of those initiatives, including the one that you just mentioned, and I think it was felt that the United States is not ready for compulsory voting at this time.
And what about the idea of what they call proportional voting? where you would avoid what happened in Florida in 2000, where people who wanted to vote for Nader could have voted Nader 1, Gore 2, and the election wouldn't have gone to Bush. In other words, you're not trapped into voting. Your vote for what you believe in ends up electing the guy that's the opposite to what you believe in.
Yeah. Actually, you can do that in one of two ways, either what's called instant runoff voting, which is what I believe you have in Australia, or proportional representation, in which you have a multi-seat district, and based on proportion of voting, you can elect individuals. Both of those initiatives could be taken at the statewide level, but it was felt for this Commission on National or Federal Election Reform, it would require a constitutional amendment and therefore would not be possible. It is possible and hopeful that some states might want to experiment with both. I think there's a lot of... We did discuss this as well. I think there are pros and cons of each of those procedures. But at the federal level, the Commission chose not to take a position on them.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Robert Pastor.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. Robert Pastor, who's the director of the Center for Democracy and Election Management and vice president of international affairs at American University. He's the executive director of the Carter-Baker Commission on Federal Election Reforms that just issued its recommendations this week. I'm now speaking with Michael Harris, who's the author of a new book on the development and testing of the United States nuclear arsenal. Mr. Harris began writing this book, The Atomic Times, in 1955, and just recently, when he was an Army draftee stationed at Eniwetok Atoll, he just finished the book 50 years later. In the meantime, he's been an executive at CBS Television, 11 years on the staff of The Ed Sullivan Show, where he had the pleasure of welcoming the Beatles at the airport from their first trip to the United States. The Atomic Times, My H-Bomb Year at the Pacific Proving Ground, is a story of a 22-year-old Army private, Michael Harris. He got an assignment to Eniwetok Atoll, the ground zero for the U.S. Joint Task Force 7th Pacific Proving Ground. There on a desolate stretch of the South Pacific, Michael Harris was part of this grand experiment called Operation Red Wing, the biggest and baddest of America's atmospheric nuclear weapons test regimes. Red Wing is one of those strange Cold War phenomenon that mix saber-rattling with mad science, with overwhelming cataclysmic human, geopolitical, and ecological effects. And let's begin just putting this in context, if we can, Michael. The United States has just will not ratify the nuclear test ban treaty that goes back to the days of Senator Kennedy. In doing so, they are joining the rogue states. Why do you think the United States would do this, given that they are essentially giving China a free pass to also not go in the join the test ban regime, which would then open China up to increasing its arsenal? We've already had a Cold War arms race with the Russians. Why would we want one with the Chinese?
Well, I think the reason is really that our administration is against nuclear treaties. You know, the Kyoto Treaty on Global Warming and the World Court and at The Hague. And they give an argument, which scientists refute, to justify their position, which is that we need to test weapons to determine the safety and reliability of our nuclear arsenal. But it's pretty hard to argue, as we do, that we should prevent nuclear proliferation and then to tell other countries that we're not going to agree to banning tests. It's as if we're saying to Iran and North Korea and all the other countries, we don't want you to have any tests, but we can go ahead and do it.
But on the other hand, the United States pressured the Europeans, and they were successful in getting the United Nations to vote to move the question of Iran's efforts to build a nuclear weapon, they've now managed to get the to refer this matter to the United Nations Security Council. The vote was 22-1. The only country supporting the Iranian position were the Venezuelans. Russia and China abstained. So I'm just puzzled here how you could want it both ways.
Well,
I know this is you're not a political scientist, but I'm just as a citizen, I'm asking you a question. You know,
I think it's great that we've achieved this at the International Atomic Energy Agency, and it would be great if our pressure on Iran results in their not developing nuclear weapons. But nevertheless, I'm sorry that we don't also have a similar position about testing. You know, we haven't tested weapons lately, but I've seen so many weapons. I've seen 12 H-bomb explosions, and in many cases, I've been aware of the devastating effects. So from my own personal point of view, I'm kind of horrified that there might be more.
Well, there was a piece, a very interesting piece that I saw in the Herald Tribune on Thursday by Bennett Ramberg, who served in the State Department under President Bush's father. And he's arguing that that not just encouraging China, U.S. breaking this trip would serve to reduce the prowess of an emerging nuclear competitor. Washington's example would also reinforce India's commitment not to test and would in turn reduce Pakistan's incentive. Ultimately, U.S. ratification would strengthen its political, moral, and normative position to combat nuclear proliferation while providing a basis to mobilize international action against violators. So I guess that's the thing. On the one hand, we got the IAEA to refer Iran, but you know, this is really a question of the nuclear haves versus the nuclear have-nots, and it would seem that the person with the most marbles should set the example.
Yes, I agree, and you know, meeting the example of that being in favor of not having nuclear tests and signing the treaty. Is that that's what you're saying, I guess?
Yeah,
I saw this article too, which I found very interesting in the Herald Tribune. And
well, it's falling on deaf ears on the White House, clearly. But let's talk about your experience at NOETOC. Did you witness the Bravo explosion?
No, I did not.
Uh-huh.
That I think was the single worst explosion.
That's the one that doused the islands and the populations with the downwinders. Ever since then, I believe everybody in the islands have had their thyroid glands removed.
Yes, including 19 Marshall Islands children, who died after Bravo, Castle Bravo test. Even though Louis Strauss, who was the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, chairman at the time, said they were recovering rapidly.
That was in the days of my friend the atom.
That's right. But I was very lucky because there were, in fact, 17 tests in Operation Red Wing, and I was there for 12, and I received a couple of letters of commendation, and my reward was to have a choice between leaving the island and leaving the Army. I was a draftee, or getting a promotion. And by rejecting the promotion was the smartest thing I ever did, because one of the five tests I didn't see is second only to Bravo, and there was fallout on the island for 3 days, and it was really deadly. And they were going to evacuate the island, in fact, and sent three or four ships to evacuate the personnel because they'd been exposed to radiation levels higher than 3.9 Rankins. which is the MPE, the maximum permissible exposure. But they decided suddenly that the evacuation was unnecessary because they just raised the MPE level to 7. So they told us everyone was now safe again. So that was, unfortunately, nuclear safety at work. And there were many people.
Mm. So nuclear safety is kind of like military intelligence.
Right. Yes.
But your book has got a wonderful kind of black humor to it. You know, it's sort of a mixture of Franz Kafka, Sergeant Bilko, and Joseph Heller.
Well, I think that one of the reasons it took me 50 years to write, and I didn't know that, was that I found that I had to be able to laugh at these people, the ones that were messing up our lives, you know.
And exposing you to cancer and death.
Yes, I mean, these people who would say we were in no danger, and we would have a fallout, and over the loudspeakers they would say it was necessary for our health and safety to close all the windows. And they would repeat that over and over, but none of the windows on the island closed.
And if they did, you'd be in a sauna, right?
Exactly. Well, I mean, but we would keep out the fallout if we had the aluminum windows were closed. But we didn't have that luxury available to us. Well, you know, it's horrible and it's funny. I guess I was finally able to see the catch 22 kind of humor in all of this. They told us that we would lose our eyesight if we weren't facing away from the blast. And one of the blasts was the first hydrogen bomb ever dropped from an airplane. And because of pilot error, they dropped it behind us, and we were facing the wrong way.
Oh, God.
So maybe if we hadn't been told in advance we were going to go blind, that was a test that I was there for. You know, and you're just in shock. So, and don't talk about it. And many men were just in denial, and they would say, oh, you've seen one H-bomb, you've seen them all. And then at night, they would scream out in their sleep, take me away from here.
So, we all probably, well, a lot of us have seen the accounts or read about the first test down in Alamogordo, and Oppenheimer's famous quote from the Bhagavad Gita, where he said that I have seen death, the destroyer of worlds. What was your reaction looking into this roiling mass of
Well, I've never felt more lonely and tiny and lost in my life. In the beginning, I thought it was only me, but it turned out that many or most of the people did feel the same way. And it's, surrealism isn't the word. It's beyond imagination. You see the bones in your hands and legs because you're being exposed to the planet's largest X-ray machine, and the ocean boils. Afterwards, there are millions of dead fish and thousands of dead birds floating on the ocean surface for miles and miles, scooped up by live sharks and barracuda. I guess you could call it fusion cuisine.
And what about the sound?
The sound was not as strong as I had imagined in advance. It was a distant rumble like thunder.
But you would still feel the
shockwave.
You would
feel, and it could be a clear, massive, rippling tsunami of air that looks like a huge roll of cellophane rushing towards you with gale force, and it almost knocks you off your feet. And the heat, it's very hot and very bright. And 2,000 miles away in Hawaii, people believed the sun was rising and the day was beginning. And the heat around the fireball was so intense that it burned away the atmosphere around the fireball, and stars not normally seen from Earth became visible.
Well, you know, it's a miracle, I think, that that none of these things went off during the Cold War, and not a nuclear shot hasn't been fired in anger since Nagasaki, although I think since the end of the Cold War, there's more likelihood of one of them going off through subnational or transnational non-state actors, as they politely describe the Bin Ladens of this world. But, you know, I still find it a terrible insult to us when people like Rumsfeld say, you know, Al-Qaeda is the greatest threat since we've ever faced. Well, we lived for 30 years with every city that could have gone up like these islands did that you witnessed, and somehow we dodged that bullet. So we've seen worse, and we've been through worse. I mean, do you agree that it's a kind of a miracle we survived?
Well, it is, but, you know, I guess each decade has its own dangers. I mean, now I suppose the worst immediate danger would be a suitcase bomb that could somehow be smuggled in. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when I was on the island, they talked about making the bomb smaller and smaller.
Well, that's the whole point of breaking the test ban treaty, so we can have a bunker buster,
right,
which makes absolutely no sense. I thank you for joining us, and for your book, Michael Harris, The Atomic Times, My H-Bomb Year at the Pacific Proving Grounds. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Same here, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Michael Harris, the author of The Atomic Times, My H-Bomb Year at the Pacific Proving Grounds. I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, and Carol Kuth, the assistant producers.